Funding for WPLN News comes from you, our listeners, and Bernstein Private Wealth, working with creators and innovators to invest with intention and build the legacy they want to leave behind. More at Bernstein.com.
I'm Khalil A. Colonna, and this is Nashville. One Generation Away is a nonprofit that rescues high-quality surplus food from grocery stores, restaurants, farms, and caterers, and redistributes that food to individuals and families experiencing food insecurity. One Generation operates through mobile pantries and doorstep delivery, and also supplies a network of partners like schools, shelters, and other food pantries. The organization has 13 full-time employees and a true army of volunteers that operate in Middle Tennessee, Northern Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle. Stacey Downey, who has a personal history of dedicated service to her neighbors and community, is currently the regional manager for One Generation Away. We're so grateful to have us here with us today. Stacey, welcome to This Is Nashville.
Hey, I'm really excited to be here.
Glad to have you here with us. And before we jump in, our producer, Catherine Cece's, she went out to learn more about One Generation Away's work and their reach. Let's take a listen.
So I wanted to see if we have pallets. How are you doing? If I can schedule to have it picked up because the other truck tire was flat, I said, I gotta go.
That's Minister Precious Stone. She runs Community Homes 33, which both houses and provides resources to unsheltered families. Every Wednesday, she rents a truck and drives to One Generation Away's warehouse to get free food for the families she serves. But today, she had to ditch the U-Haul and pivot to a minivan. Not showing up was not an option.
I feed in the houses 50 families. Then on top of that, I'm feeding the community. So I usually do hot meals too, along with food boxes. And kids eat a lot of food, especially the boys.
One Generation Away gets food out into the community through supplying community partners like Community Homes 33, as well as running mobile pantries and a doorstep delivery pantry. This morning, six volunteers are ready at the warehouse to help load vehicles up with donated food.
We can drop that chicken right here. Is that pickles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The van fills up with frozen chicken, pasta, canned soup, canned vegetables, snack bars, cereal, boxed water, and pizza kits. In about 10 minutes, the job is done and Minister Stone gets ready to set off. With only 13 staff members and a true legion of volunteers, One Gen operates three warehouses and reaches across Middle Tennessee, Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle. Chris and Elaine Whitney founded the organization in 2013 after personally needing help getting food.
Elaine and I had suffered food insecurity. We had a daughter born with spina bifida in a really rough year work-wise, and we were in a food line for 6 months.
Once they were back on their feet financially, they wanted to help others in need. They started with a small SUV and a tip from a friend that a Whole Foods had good food to give away that would otherwise end up in a dumpster.
We didn't have a warehouse, so we had to give it away when we picked it up. So we started going into lower income communities and just giving it away, and we still do that to this day. So every day we rescue food, it's on someone's table that night.
One Gen is known for having a no questions asked policy. If you show up, you will get food. That makes a difference at One Gen's mobile pantry. On a very windy Saturday morning in Spring Hill, Tennessee, about an hour southwest of Nashville, a very, very long line of cars waits at the ready at a community college parking lot. Annie Stewart and her 9-year-old daughter, Georgia, have shown up to be a set of helping hands.
On a Saturday where we can, I try to get her involved. Where we can help, we try to help.
After a short orientation, Annie and Georgia each grab a shopping cart and move through several set-up stations, stopping long enough at each for other volunteers to fill their carts to the brim.
I'm going to give you three more.
So it looks like we have some prepackaged salads, lots of fruits and vegetables. So we've got strawberries and cantaloupe, some bread, onions, pineapple. Some cupcakes.
Come on down, guys.
Following direction, they maneuver the heavy carts across the bumpy asphalt to a designated spot where they wait for the cars. The people in the car line look exactly like anyone you would see at a grocery store on a Saturday morning. Robert is a retiree who has three family members living with him. A friend told him about the mobile pantry.
When you're on a fixed income, it makes a big difference, you know.
Judy shares the groceries she gets with her daughter and grandkids to help stretch their budgets.
I've been coming for quite a while. I came years ago when my husband was suffering from his cancer. Cancer's expensive, and we really needed the help.
Jose, a dad with a 14-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son, is at the mobile pantry for the second time.
Well, it's the tough times, and this really helps for my kids and I.
No one gets any questions, only smiles and groceries. Behind the scenes, Chrislyn Ledbetter, a One Gen team member, keeps an eye on the whole operation.
Some people get here the night before and sleep in their car because they want to be sure to be the first in line and not get turned away. It's sad to see that level of need, but we're so happy to meet that need.
This March, 40% of Tennessee families reported that they were unsure of where their next meal will come from. The need is very real, but there is still shame around food assistance. Whitney, One Gen's founder, is dedicated to changing the narrative.
There's nothing to be shameful about. Life's full of seasons. It's a season. Hold your head up. Just know that there are people out there that aren't looking down on you. They're here to walk with you.
For This Is Nashville, I'm Catherine Cecis. A quick note to our listeners. We're about to jump back into Khalil's conversation with Stacey Downey. Since the recording of this conversation, she has stepped into a different job. She still wholeheartedly supports One Generation Away's mission.
Now, One Generation Away, their mission is, quote, share hope, honor, and dignity through food. You've been working with them for a little while. Tell me, what is your day-to-day? Because tackling hunger is a huge job. What's your day-to-day look like?
It is a huge job, and every day is different, which is what I love, because we just kind of, anything that comes through the door, you know, we need to be able to help whoever it is. So we may have a family who shows up at our warehouse. We're not really set up to do food distribution from there, but of course we're going to, you know, see what they need and do what we can. We have big trucks that go out every single morning, 6 days a week, and rescue food. And so they go to maybe up to 12 locations in the morning, and then they'll go drop off at a nonprofit or a shelter that same day. So that food is going straight to families by that evening. So that can always throw some challenges. You just never know what's going to happen.
What do you enjoy most about your work?
Oh, wow. I love the environment. I've known Chris and Elaine, the founders, for a long, long time. They supported the Little Pantry for many, many years by bringing us one of those big trucks every week. And so I know their heart, and I appreciate being a part of something so important and something that they're so passionate about. I'm just really grateful to be able to be in a place where I know that we can make a difference.
Now, One Generation Away rescues food from restaurants and stuff. Tell me about the parameters. Like, where does the food exactly come from, and what types of food are you all rescuing?
Yeah, so we have truck drivers that go out 6 days a week, starting at 6 a.m., and they will go to grocery stores, they go to restaurants, they go to coffee shops. They go anywhere that there's still good food that for some reason is not going to be sold. It's perfectly good food. We don't take anything that's not going to be something that we would feed to our own families. So they will load that up and usually end up with anywhere from maybe about 2,500 to maybe 6,000 pounds of food per truck. And then they will go straight to whichever nonprofit they're going to that day, unload it, and then the nonprofit gets it out to families that day. So it could come from anywhere. I mean, we're not going to turn down food. We get food from farms, grocery stores, restaurants. That's our main source for that rescue program.
I mean, 2,500 to 6,000 pounds of food per truck for 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of food going out there that would normally go to waste.
Yeah.
When you think about that and your history of working with people who suffer from food insecurity and live in areas where there are food deserts, what does that make you think about how our society treats food and access to food?
Yeah, it's pretty sad. And the sad part is, you know, we all just kind of get in these patterns and we don't even realize, you know, that we ourselves are wasting food. Places where we buy food is, you know, all this food is going to waste. But I think probably a lot of people don't see the hunger like we do. You know, if you've never been in that world, how would you even know? You may hear about it and you may think, oh, there's some places out there, there's a food pantry that's helping some people. But I think it's hard to have a grasp on how big this problem is unless you've been in this world. And I think it's also hard for people to relate. You know, because if you're doing okay, you think everybody's doing okay, but the truth is it could be your neighbor who is struggling to put food on the table.
And you just don't know.
You just don't know.
If someone or their family, they need food assistance, how can they get access to the food that One Generation Away, you know, provides?
So the easiest way is to come to a mobile pantry. Those are on Saturday mornings. They're all over Nashville and different counties all around Nashville. So you can look that up on our website. You just drive up. There are no questions asked, which is something that I'm really, really super passionate about. They just drive through, and you'll get a buggy, literally a shopping cart full of food. It's going to be produce. It's going to be dairy, maybe yogurt. It could be milk. It's going to be bread. It's going to be pastries, shelf-stable items like canned vegetables, canned fruit, rice, just kind of anything that you would get from the grocery store if you were going on a big shopping trip. So you'll get that for free.
What is it about the no questions asked policy that's so attractive to you?
Well, I mean, if you showed me your license, it's not going to tell me much about you. You know, I can look at your ID, and it's not going to tell me that you're a granny who's raising grandkids that you never expected to. You know, it's not going to tell me that you lost your job. You know, you had a crazy car expense, and you just can't make ends meet this week. You know, ID's not going to tell me anything about you, so why?
Mm.
It's pointless.
I understand that. Now, let's step back for a minute. You grew up in Mississippi, came to Nashville. You've been here for over 25 years. And during that time, you have found many ways to connect, make a real difference for people and their lives in this city. You started off volunteering with literacy programs and reentry programs. Then you later got involved with the West Nashville Partnership and helped build wheelchair ramps and do home repairs. And since your early 20s, you have made it a real effort in your life to volunteer and to help others. Where did that drive to do that come from?
I don't really know. I mean, just you feel like you need to be part of something bigger than yourself, I guess. I mean, I think most people need that, maybe never get it. But to get outside your own 3 feet was very important to me. It's pretty miserable in here if you stay, you know, within your own self. So just to be part of a community, part of something bigger than you. And, you know, it'd be nice to say, like, oh, you make a difference. That sounds so good. And it's what everybody says. But, you know, it's kind of selfish, too. Self-preservation, I guess, to try to just not be in the me game. That's, to me, that's pretty miserable.
What has volunteering, this spirit of giving, what has that given you?
I mean, it's brought a lot of incredible people to my life. That's probably the biggest gift I've ever had, is to have people from all walks of life who I love and who I know, not just in passing. You know, these are people that are my family, you know, people that I adore and still talk to every single day, and to have only associated with people who are exactly like me and live in my neighborhood. You know, that's not what I want. You know, I want a lot of cool, interesting people in my life. And I got it.
You got it.
Oh, man.
You know, in 2010, the flood hit Middle Tennessee and ended up being a really huge turning point for you. Explain how you went from volunteering with FEMA after the flood to starting a food pantry.
Well, I was actually volunteering with a guy who had gotten a space in the basement of this church in West Nashville, and he was doing like FEMA applications, but he was also doing some food and things like that. He actually owned a farm. So he was bringing in a little food here and there and just doing lots of different things for flood recovery. And about October in 2010, he was closing up. And I was like, wait a minute, I really am digging this. I love these people in West Nashville. I was really getting to know everybody there. There was actually a large population of people who were living outside at the time in West Nashville, and it's kind of a hidden population. Not many people knew them or saw them or paid attention. So when he was getting ready to close up, I knew that space would be empty. So I went upstairs and talked to the pastor, and I said, I have no idea what I'm doing, but you give me this space and let me see what I can do. And she said, sure, kid, whatever. She thought I'd be gone in a couple months, and, you know, there we were 6 years later in that space.
It became the little pantry that could. Where did the name come from?
We were just sitting around one day kind of joking about, you know, we had no money. myself and a volunteer, we were paying for it every week out of pocket. She would buy 1 week, I would buy 1 week. And we just said, it's fine, we don't really worry about it. You know, something always comes through. And she said, yeah, we're like the little engine that could. And, you know, there it was.
Mm. What was the goal? You started this thing, you had no idea what you were doing. You and one volunteer paying out of your own pockets to make things happen. What was your goal back then?
So to be honest, my goal was pretty dumb. I had this ridiculous idea that this was going to be like a boutique food pantry. It was going to be, you know, very fancy, and we would have eggplant and rainbow carrots, and, you know, I was not going to have cereal and macaroni and cheese in my food pantry. It was so stupid, but it was my own idea, and it was all for me. And so that got knocked out pretty quickly because it was a dumb idea, made no sense at all. After a couple of weeks of doing this, I saw people would take the bags of food that they had just gotten and they'd go back and sit down and eat every single thing in their bag. So I was like, wow, these people are hungry. You know, they don't care about a rainbow carrot. They need food. They need whatever's going to fill a belly. And so that was a pivotal moment. I've had a couple. That was a big one when I realized this is not about me and what I want to do. It's about what people need. And so from that day, fortunately, it changed my life because it showed me that I need to look at the person and say, what do you need? Instead of them looking at me and asking me, what could I do? It's totally different.
And that's different than asking them, what do they want as well?
Yeah. Well, and I'm big about that too, because, you know, we grew an outreach program in the pantry too, and it grew and grew. And that was a big deal, is to ask people, what do you want? Because it's not what I want for you. You know, we did a lot, changing subjects, but we did a lot in our outreach. You know, we found people housing. We did rehab referrals. We did a whole lot of different things. But, you know, I could never look at a person and say, this is what you should be doing. You should get sober and get inside, because maybe that's not what they wanted for their life. You know, these are grown-ups. They make their decisions. I decided to walk with them instead of walk over them. And, you know, it turned out pretty good.
All right, let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our talk with Stacy Downey about the Little Pantry and what it's like running and growing a pantry and outreach programs here in North Nashville. Stay with us. This is Nashville. I'm Khalil Ekolona, and this is Nashville. Today, we're talking with Stacy Downey, who has founded and ran the Little Pantry and continues to work to end hunger with one generation away. Stacy, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so you started the Little Pantry, and it didn't take you long before you started reaching out to and reaching a lot of people. From what I understand, over a short time, you went from serving 15 people to over 100. Talk to me about that initial growth, what it was like, what was going through your mind as you saw the numbers pick up so quickly.
Yeah, well, it was, again, when I started this, I seriously had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I worked in ophthalmology and had never done anything like this before. But, you know, when something like this happens, you just kind of got to go with it. And it was organic growth. It's not like we were out there, you know, advertising. But people needed help. And if we could figure out how to help, I mean, it was a no-brainer. We just needed to do it and just roll with it.
So the numbers came, you adjusted, and met the needs that people had.
Yeah.
What was the one thing? What was the one of the biggest things that you learned early on?
Well, I've learned that it's not about me. It's about what people need. That was a big thing. And I had another pivotal moment early on. We were, you know, running a food pantry and, you know, it was going okay. And one night it was really, really cold and raining. And I had this guy come in and I was there working late and had the light on. So I guess he saw the light on and he decided to come by. And I knew this guy, like he comes and gets food every week. And, you know, I knew his name, I knew his family, all these things. And he came in and he goes, hey, do you have any shoes? And I was like, no, we don't have shoes. We're food pantry, you know. And He said, okay. So I looked at his shoes, and they were, like, you know, falling apart. And it was raining and cold. So I had a box of stuff, and I said, let me look, you know, in this box and see what I can find. And so I had a pair of shoes. So I said, well, try them on, you know, make sure they fit before you take them. And he was like, no, it's fine. I'm just going to take them. And I was like, no, you need to try them on, you know, because if you can't use them, I'll give them to somebody else. So we went around and around for like 10 minutes. And finally he was like, I don't want to take my shoes off in front of you. And it was because he said somebody on the bus had taught him how to wrap his feet in plastic bags and just to keep them sort of dry. And so that was like so stunning to me because I knew this guy, you know, and I never looked at his shoes. I never thought about the crazy things he would have to do just to, you know, make it back and forth to the bus stop. And so that, to me, it was like, it was just so eye-opening because I was like, here you go again. You're just, you know, you're thinking about what you want to do. You're not really looking at people in a real significant way, you know, that's going to do what they need. So at that point, we started our outreach programs. And we also tried to, you know, increase food resources too. I mean, we were always trying to do that, but we just realized you can do a lot, but it's absolutely nothing. I mean, this fight is so huge. You just got to throw everything at it. And you just got to throw everything at it that you can and forget about yourself.
The people who volunteered and worked with you, did you impart that ethos upon to them? Hey, it's not about what you want or what you desire. It's about giving the people who are coming to us asking for help what they need.
I mean, I don't think I really had to impart anything because the people who came there and got it, I mean, they were amazing. And somehow it was just this magical whole thing. You know, it wasn't long before volunteers that came in just to, you know, help people get food were like, hey, you know, I can cut hair, or hey, I can give rides. Hey, I can do this. And I was like, hey, yeah, we're all in, like whatever they need. And so that's how we grew so many diverse programs. You know, we were, it was like had very little to do with food. Honestly, the whole time it had a lot to do with people and it had a lot to do with just doing what they needed. So, yeah, just, I mean, it just happened very naturally because they were great people, but the people we were serving were amazing people. And, you know, you couldn't help but want to get to know them, you know, and just like be part of their family, just like they became part of our family.
How did you feel as you began to understand the enormity of the issues that the community faces?
Well, I mean, it would have been easy to become overwhelmed, but there's kind of no time for that. But I feel like it was important for me to not really count victories, because I think the minute, if I had ever let myself think, okay, we're doing a lot, like we're good, then maybe we would have stopped trying so hard. You know, we let our guard down or become complacent or even satisfied with what we're doing. There's no satisfaction in giving a 70-year-old man a tent to live in. You know, there's zero satisfaction in that. I mean, there's zero satisfaction in giving somebody who's living outside, you know, a really nice coat and warm socks. That's ridiculous. How could you be happy about that? You know, because you know it's not even a Band-Aid. And really, these are human beings who shouldn't be in this situation. So I think I always had to be of the mind that, you know, okay, cool, but we got to do more.
You know, a lot of people out there who volunteer feel very satisfied with themselves by giving a bag of non-perishable items or giving away a coat and something. But you say we shouldn't feel satisfied with that help.
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel good about it. Of course, anything good you do is a good thing. But I think if you look deeper beyond your role in it and you see the person who is in need, I think that's where your thought patterns change.
If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville, and I'm your host, Khalil Akalona. We're tuning in this hour with Stacey Downey. She's the founder of The Little Pantry That Could and works to bring food to those in need. Talk to me about the type of work you were doing. How many hours were you working per day?
Oh, man, it was a lot. For the first 6 years or so, I kept my full-time job. I was working for an ophthalmic surgeon who was a saint. I love him to death. And so he gave me Fridays off because that's when our trucks came in to unload food. But then every other minute, all weekend, every night, you know, it was taking up all my time, which was good because, I mean, it was such a gift. You know, it wasn't even like work. And to have all these amazing people in my life and, you know, being surrounded by all these amazing people. I mean, there's nothing like it. It's actually hard to describe. So it was a lot. And then finally some things changed and we had grown so much that I went ahead, quit my job and started being, you know, full-time pantry lady.
Did you ever feel tired?
Oh, I mean, yeah, of course you're exhausted. Like you're ridiculously exhausted. But, you know, it's not like adrenaline because it's just a steady feeling like this is what I'm meant to do, you know, and what could be better, really? I mean, people go on vacation to feel like this, and, you know, I just went to work to feel like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Rowdy. Who was he and what did he mean to you?
Oh, Rowdy dog. I did this little blog every week.
Take your time.
I do this blog every week after the pantry, just kind of let people know what had happened. You know, not numbers and all that stuff that doesn't matter, but, you know, something significant that had happened, you know, about a person or people. And so one day I was in the alley when we were still back on Charlotte Avenue, and there was a guy who lived outside. His name was Will. He's an awesome guy, and he had this big old lump of a dog named Rowdy Dog. I don't know why they called him Rowdy, because he wasn't super rowdy, but he was a sweetheart. But, you know, there's always something going on. Somebody was always coming by telling me, you know, why are you doing this? People are taking advantage of you. You know, you're enabling, and, you know, other dumb words I hate. So there was always that. But Rowdy Dog comes walking down the alley every day I'm open, and, you know, his tail's wagging. He's, like, got this big old dog smile on his face, and he is always happy to meet whoever. Like, every encounter he sees as a good thing. Mm-hmm. He's expecting something good from every single person that he's going to meet that day. And I was like, dang, I would love to be more like Rowdy. I wish we all were more like Rowdy. Like, especially now, you know, you'll go somewhere and you're kind of looking over your shoulder. You're thinking, is somebody going to get in a fight? Is somebody have a gun? Is somebody going to run me off the road? All very real concerns, especially nowadays. But I don't want to do that. I want to expect something good to happen with every single person that I meet. So I think about Rowdy Dog all the time. And, you know, if we could just do that instead of meeting people with suspicion or anger or immediately try to find, like, what's different with you, what's wrong with you, you know, if we could just be like, hey, this is going to be an awesome person and maybe they'll be in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was Rowdy Dog. He taught me a lot.
Yeah. It seems like there's this unselfishness where you want to have a good encounter with every person. And yet we're here in times that are very divisive politically. A lot of people feel skeptical, like you said, of others. What will it take for us to kind of let go of that skepticism, let go of that mistrust, and to walk into situations with strangers and people we know quite well to have good interactions?
Yeah, I wish I had that answer. I wish we all had that answer. But for myself, I just try to keep my little corner of the world peaceful, and I try to remember what's important. You know, before I started doing this, I can remember, you know, I worked in medical and I worked with people who, you know, made pretty good money and had pretty happy lives. And, you know, we talked about, like, their lawns.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? We mm-hmm. talked about, you know, these, like, horrible challenges they were facing. Like, you know, they didn't have something in stock at the store that they really wanted. You know, and so once I cross over to this other world where people are real, you know, and they have so little and they give so much. And really all they have to give is just, you know, themselves and their company and their hearts and their love. I mean, it really, that's what changed it for me. And it makes me very sad to see in this world the things that we argue about, because I know that there are people who literally are swirling in the aftermath of these decisions that we make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're not doing well. They're not going to do well. And we never even consider them. You know, it's just like you will stomp around and say, I won. You know, I argued with you and I won. And you don't really think about how that's going to affect other people who weren't even in the fight.
So, you know, this authenticity that comes with the folks that you worked with. I mean, you're talking about when you were at work and working for the doctor in the medical field, people have what we call first world problems that they complained about. Then you're meeting people with just simple problems of survival and eating.
Yeah.
And they're real.
Definitely.
And those are the connections that gave you, is it fair to say, faith and hope in others?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and just, you know, reality. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was actually such a gift, again, just to be able to be in reality instead of in this thing that is so made up about what's important and what isn't. So, yeah, I mean, when you see somebody who, you know, who slept outside, you know, the night before, and you're kind of holding your breath for when they come in the next morning just to see, you know, do you have all your toes? You know, are you still alive? I mean, that changes your perspective quite a bit.
Yeah. Let's take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Stacey Downey and learn more about how and why she dedicates herself to serving the community. You can join the conversation by tweeting us at This Is Nashville. We'll be right back. I'm Khalil A. Colonna, and this is Nashville. Today, we're joined by Stacey Downey, founder of The Little Pantry That Could, a food pantry that ended up providing a lot more than food to the community it served. Stacey, again, thank you so much for being here. Grateful.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we were talking about this perspective shift that you had in doing this work. There was also a shift in The Little Pantry That Could. You all found a new space. You found a home in North Nashville in Dodge City, and you had to really complete a lot of renovations around this space, I understand. What was the condition of the space when you first found it?
Oh, it was really bad. This building hadn't been used for years and years, had no electric run to it, no plumbing. Somebody had been kind of squatting in one of the back rooms and set it on fire. It was pretty bad. So, but there was nothing to be found. This was right at the kind of the height of gentrification in West Nashville, and we had rented that space in a basement of a church for like a little over 6 years on Charlotte Avenue, and they sold that building. So we had to go somewhere. So I drove by this building. I was kind of making eyes at this building every time I went by it and found out who owned it, and it was a church. And I went in. I'd been out doing outreach all day, so I'd been in the woods. Like, I had sticks in my hair, had a dog in the car. You know, it was crazy. I just stopped on a whim and went in and met the pastor and an elder who were two amazing people. And I said, hey, I want to rent this building. And they said, no, you don't. I said, yeah, I do. So they said, well, it's in bad shape. I said, I don't care. It's where I need to be. You know, North Nashville is where we really needed to be at that time. And so he said, well, we're going to have a meeting in a couple weeks. You know, I'll let you know what they say. And so he called me before I got home, and he said, why don't you come back and just look at it? So turned around, went back, and he opened the door, and I looked down. I could see the basement. There was no floor.
Ooh.
You had to walk in on the beams in most of the rooms, and it was rough. No walls, no ceiling. You know, there were birds in there, so it was bad. So we made a deal. They would give me a 5-year lease if I did all the renovations, and so that's what we did. We got to work and got a hard hats and sledgehammers and got a lot of people on board. We were so fortunate that a lot of businesses and people just jumped in and helped us keep our costs down. But yeah, it was actually really, really nice on the day we gave them the keys back.
How long did it take you to renovate and get that place in shape?
Oh man, it was, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that was pretty much day and night. I mean, literally some people spent the night there and worked all night.
How'd that make you feel to see so many people come to help you get this, the new location of the Little Pantry that could up and operational?
I mean, it was great, but it was nothing that wasn't unexpected, because I think, and it's so hard to describe it, because if you had never been there, you would have to be there and just feel it. But at the Little Pantry, people walked in and it either scared the hell out of them or they were all in. It was just like that. So the people who were all in were all in. So to see that dedication, you know, and it wasn't just volunteers. I mean, it was a lot of recipients, too. A lot of the people who were our guests every Saturday and had been, they were there. People who were our outreach clients, they were there. You know, even if you didn't have a certain skill, there's always something you could do.
Mm-hmm. So you get the place fixed up. You're opening the doors, officially ready to help and operate and work with people. What was traffic like? Did you have an influx of folks come in to help? Were you busier than you were at the previous location in West Nashville?
Oh, yeah. We started growing. It took a minute for the folks in West Nashville to find us, you know, to be able to get over there, because it's two bus rides, and it was, I think it cost like $8 or something by the time you took two buses to get over there. So it took a minute. But in North Nashville, I mean, that was an area that was largely ignored, especially at that time, and there was a lot of people in need. So that was a natural growth. But, I mean, even from day one, we had people who would come from all over. You know, we had people who came from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. People came from Dixon.
Wow.
Lots of people came from Sumner County. They came from all over because it's hard to get food. It's hard to get help. And it's hard to get help without all the stuff you have to do to get help. So at our place, we never asked questions. I never wanted any paperwork. We didn't ask you anything, you know, because, you know, I just don't feel like anybody who's having a hard time should be quizzed about their circumstances. Like, who cares? You know, here you are. I got food. You need food. Come on in. It's just pretty much that simple. So I think that's why we saw so much growth, is because it was easy.
You said you don't want anyone to be quizzed about their circumstances in order to receive help. And there's a lot of organizations, a lot of folks out there. Someone walking down the street, hey, you know, do you have a couple dollars? And they'll offer that help, but they have parameters, strict parameters set to what they can spend that money on. That's unconventional, this approach that you take, you know? And what does that say to you about society and the conditions that we put on people in order just to give them the help that they just naturally deserve?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's largely the system. And, you know, I can't say that I knock it, because if they're still doing good things for some people, you know, the ones they deem deserving, then that's cool. It's just definitely not for me. And to me, it's just easier. I'll never forget, I had a volunteer, really nice lady. You know, she was done volunteering and we were walking out the door and she says, hey, I got like $10. I was thinking about giving this to, you know, one of the guys. You know, what do you think he'll spend it on? And I said, I have no idea what I'll spend it on. I was like, you give me $10, I don't know what I'll spend it on. Mm-hmm. I might spend it on dog food. I might spend it on wine. I mean, I don't know. So why do you even care? Like, give it or don't. And so, I mean, that was always my approach. And a lot of people weren't down with that, which didn't matter to me. You know, a lot of people said people are taking advantage of you, which makes no sense, because if you're giving something freely, I mean, it's impossible to take advantage, because, you know, there it is. But I never wanted to spend my time trying to figure out what people were doing right and wrong. You know, I don't want anybody doing that for me. So why would I do that about somebody else? So, you know, people are in different places in their life. Some people have, you know, issues with addiction. I mean, that's just where they're at. Some people ended up in that situation who absolutely never did a thing wrong. You know, paid their rent on time, you know, were responsible, raised their kids, whatever, and then just life just smacked them. You know, so why do I want to figure out all that?
What did the people you were serving, what did they say? Has anyone ever came up to you and appreciated, thanked you for the approach that you took?
Of course. I mean, billions of times, because, you know, if somebody is coming to a food pantry, they are clearly not having their best day. Mm-hmm. Something's going on. So why do I want to make your day any worse? You know, why do I want to make your life any harder? It's not my place. It's not what I'm there to do. And so a lot of people did appreciate that, you know, because It literally takes one event to change a person's world. You know, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people. And I think we all need to realize that. You know, it takes one huge medical bill, you know, one huge car repair, whatever, you know, 2 weeks out of work, and everything can change for you. So I feel like it was not my place to make people have a harder time. I wanted them to have an easier time, you know.
Mm-hmm. 2022, the pantry closes.
Yeah.
What eventually happened? What was that like?
Well, it was not a surprise at all. I knew they were going to take the building back. I mean, that was a no-brainer. You know, we'd put $300,000 in it, and it was, you know, it was an awesome building by the time we got done. But what was a surprise is that was right, you know, because I looked for almost 2 years. I mean, I had three realtors. I had big developers. Lots of people were helping us look for a building because we knew that was coming. And we had money in the bank. I mean, we had good money, you know, put towards a building fund. But the timing was terrible because it was right when all this madness happened in Nashville real estate. And so, you know, there was no way to have enough money to buy a commercial building at that time. And so it was just really terrible timing. We looked at a church, would have been a pretty decent thing. It was on the market for $2.5 million, which was insane to me, like astronomical, because I know what I could do with $2.5 million to help people, not, you know, buy real estate. But we didn't have it. But I talked to him and I said, hey, you know, if I can figure it out, I'll make a full price offer and let you stay and keep doing your services here till you find another place and all this. And they countered with $6.5 million.
Mm.
And so at that, I mean, it was over. Like, we all knew it was over. So we kind of, I had to pivot and prepare for, you know, the end, which I really never planned to do. You know, I was always pretty confident that we would find another place.
How'd that make you feel about Nashville?
Oh, you don't want to know. Yeah, I fell out of love with Nashville right about that point.
Are you still out of love with Nashville?
For sure.
Yeah.
Not the people.
But?
Just what they've done to the people. What has been allowed to happen.
You stayed until the last hour until they came to take the keys.
Oh, yeah.
What'd you do after you handed them over?
I don't even remember. I think we, you know, there's a bunch of people there. Everybody wanted to be there. I don't even remember.
Is that, is the building that you poured your heart and soul and love into to renovate, is it occupied now?
Mm-mm. Sitting there empty.
It's empty.
Still empty. Just sitting there.
What does that tell you about this town?
I can't speak for the people who made that decision. But it just shows me that it wasn't important to the people who made that decision. Not near as important as it was to the people who, again, are swirling in the aftermath of that decision.
Again, decisions that are made without consideration of how the repercussions affect others.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you know what happened to the people you served?
Oh, I still talk to them 50 times a day. I mean, that doesn't end. I still do a lot of outreach on the side, you know, helping people with housing and referrals and, you know, all the same stuff that we used to do. Just, it's tough now because you don't have the time, for sure. You don't have the funds. But there's still a lot of things I can do, just, you know, from knowing how to get around stuff. So they're still my people. You know, I talk to them, I see them. You know, all of us, like, we all became family, and that doesn't go away just because geography changed.
Mm-hmm. You're now working with one generation away, having all this experience of being there on the ground, 6, sometimes 7 days a week, I imagine.
Always seven.
Helping people. You know, how does it feel to you, given everything that you've been through and this work that you're continuing to do? How do you feel?
Well, I mean, again, I have to always lead with gratitude. Otherwise, I'd be, you know, bitter and no fun to be around. So I'm very grateful that I get to still work with an organization that I believe in. Chris and Elaine are like two of the best people I've ever known in my life. So I have to be super, super grateful about that. It's very different work. You know, it feels 100,000 miles away from what I used to do, but it's still good work.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to say to Nashville city leaders about what they can do to help support our vulnerable neighbors?
Yeah, I think I've said it all in all my, you know, billions of calls to the mayor's office and, you know, our council people. And it was like I probably had better conversations with my dog. So I don't know what to say because it's clear it's profits over people. And, you know, please understand a lot of people are upset at people who've moved here. I moved here one time. Like Nashville opened its arms and said, come on in. And that's cool. So not upset at all about all the people moving here. Even though I sit in traffic a lot, it's okay. It's my choice. But the fact that we let this growth happen and let people, Nashvillians, or, you know, become displaced and lose their homes and, you know, all those things. That's what I'm upset about. It's not the people who came here. It's just the way that we, you know, let this growth just throw people out. That's what wasn't cool.
What do you want regular citizens to do? People who aren't public officials?
Oh, wow. It'd just be so nice if people could just look beyond stereotypes and look beyond themselves. And, you know, and it's great if you stop and you give somebody some money, give somebody some food, but, you know, it's a whole lot better if you could actually just connect with a person. You know, maybe you're not going to, you know, be able to help every single person, but, you know, there's a million stories where somebody, you know, just ran into a guy on the street and found out, you know, his needs were pretty basic in our world. You know, it was life-changing to him, and maybe you can do those things, and, you know, he can get where he needs to be. You know, I mean, you have the power. You don't have to have it figured all out. You don't have to work for a nonprofit. You know, you don't have to be a genius. You know, just be a human and see another person as a human. Mm. A big, like, my whole core system is built on Ubuntu. It's my favorite thing. Just knowing that your humanity is tied to my humanity. You know, you're doing good, I'm doing good. You're having a bad day. You know, it's gonna affect everybody. And so just knowing that I'm responsible for everybody. To me, it's kind of an easier way to think than picking and choosing. You know, I'm just gonna be kind to these people, or I'm just gonna understand these people. It's just easier just to open the door.
You're talking about this selflessness, but we're Americans. We're kind of selfish. It's kind of embedded into our culture. Think about me, 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 I. What's your message to the people of Nashville?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true, but it's a choice. So, you know, you can choose to be that way. A lot of people will live their lives that way all the way to the end. And, you know, so that's on you. But to me, the minute I decided to open the door to other people and just love people, I mean, just love them until they give me a reason not to, you know, which could happen. Mm-hmm. It's just so much easier. So it's not really selfless. It's selfish because it's just an easier way instead of meeting people with, you know, anger, people I don't even know. How can you be angry with people you don't even know? That's where we have become so divisive. And that's crazy to me. You know, I think about an example. I used to have terrible road rage. Golly, I'm surprised I'm not dead.
It was bad, huh?
Oh, man, it was so bad. I get so mad. And then one day I was going up the ridge, and I've been messing with this guy. He's messing with me, and I got to the top of the ridge, and he pulled out a gun and, like, waved it, you know, through the window, and I was like, whoa. And I was like, this was stupid. You know, he doesn't know me. I don't know him. It wasn't personal. He's not trying to run me off the road. He's not, you know, he's just a bad driver, and I am too at this point. So that changed my way of thinking because I started realizing, like, it's not personal. You know, people are just doing their thing, getting ahead. They really don't understand, you know, what's important, and I didn't either. So I'm learning every day how to figure out what's important and what isn't.
Hopefully we all are.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Stacy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Stacy Downey is a regional manager for One Generation Away. If you need food assistance or would like to support their mission, please go to onegenerationaway.com or you can find them on social media. And thanks to you for tuning in this hour. This is Nashville. It's a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced and directed by Catherine Cecis. Our board operator is Liv Lombardi. The masterminds behind our theme music are LaRange and Namir Blade. You can listen back at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And the conversation doesn't end here. Tweet us at This Is Nashville. Find us on Instagram and tell us what you want from our show by filling out our quick survey online. This is Nashville. I'm Khalil A. Colonna. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And be good to each other.